Chapter 25. We went into Father Fernando's office, where he summoned up his memories, adopting the tone of a sermon. He sculpted his sentences neatly, measuring them out with a cadence that seemed to promise an ultimate moral that never came. Years of teaching had left him with that firm and didactic tone of someone used to being heard, but not certain of being listened to. "If I remember correctly, Julian Carax started at San Gabriel's in 1914. I got along with him right away because we both belonged to the small group of pupils who did not come from wealthy families. They called us the Starving Gang, and each one of us had his own special story. I'd managed to get a scholarship thanks to my father, who worked in the kitchens of this school for 25 years. Julian had been accepted thanks to the intercession of Signor Aldaya, who was a customer of the Fortuny hat shop, owned by Julian's father. Those were different times, of course. And during those days, power was still concentrated within families and dynasties. That world has vanished. The last few remains were swept away with the fall of the Republic. For the better, I suppose. All that is left are the names on the letterheads of companies, banks, and faceless consortiums. Like all old cities, Barcelona is a sum of its ruins. The great glories so many people are proud of, palaces, factories, and monuments, the emblems with which we identify, are nothing more than relics of an extinguished civilization. Having reached this point, Father Fernando allowed for a solemn pause, in which he seemed to be waiting for the congregation to answer with some empty Latin phrase or a response from the missal. "Amen, Reverend Father. What great truth lies in those wise words," offered Fermin to fill the awkward silence. "You were telling us about my father's first year at the school," I put in gently. Father Fernando nodded. "In those days, he already called himself Carax, although his paternal surname was Fortuny. First, some of the boys teased him for that, and for being one of the Starving Gang, of course. They also laughed at me because I was the cook's son. You know what kids are like. Deep down, God has filled them with the goodness, but they repeat what they hear at home." "Little angels," punctuated Fermin. "What do you remember about my father?" "Well, it's such a long time ago. Your father's best friend at that time was not Jorge Aldaya, but a boy called Miquel Moliner. Miquel's family was almost as wealthy as the Aldayas, and I dare say he was the most extravagant pupil this school has ever seen. The headmaster thought he was possessed by the devil because he recited Marx in German during Mass." "A clear sign of possession," Fermin agreed. "Miquel and Julian got on extremely well. Sometimes we three would get together during the lunch break, and Julian would tell us stories. Other times he would tell us about his family and the Aldayas." The priest seemed to hesitate. "Even after leaving school, Miquel and I stayed in touch for a time. Julian had already gone to Paris by then. I know that Miquel missed him. He often spoke about him, remembering secrets Julian had once confided in him. Later, when I entered the seminary, Miquel told me I'd gone over to the enemy. It was meant as a joke, but the fact is that we drifted apart."
"Do you remember hearing that Miquel married someone called Nuria Montfort?"
"Miquel married?
Do you find that odd?"
"I suppose I shouldn't, but I don't know. The truth is that I haven't heard from Miquel for years, since before the war."
"Did he ever mention the name of Nuria Montfort?"
"No, never."
"And he didn't say he was thinking of getting married or that he had a fiancée. Listen, I'm not at all sure that I should be talking to you about this. These are personal things Julian and Miquel told me, with the understanding that they would remain between us."
"And are you going to refuse a son his only chance of discovering his father's past?" asked Fermin.
Father Fernando was torn between doubt
and it seemed to me the wish to remember, to recover those lost days. I suppose so many years have gone by that it doesn't matter anymore. I can still remember the day when Julian told us how he'd met the Aldaers and how, without realizing it, his life was changed forever. In October 1914, an artifact that many took to be a pantheon on wheels stopped one afternoon in front of the Fortuny hat shop on Ronda de San Antonio. From it emerged the proud, majestic and arrogant figure of Don Ricardo Aldaya. By then, already one of the richest men, not only in Barcelona, but also in the whole of Spain. His textile empire took in citadels of industry and colonies of commerce along all the rivers of Catalonia. His right hand held the reins of the banks and landed estates of half the province. His left hand, ever active, pulled at the strings of the provincial council, the city hall, various ministries, the bishopric, and the customs service at the port. That afternoon, the man with exuberant moustache and kingly sideburns, whom everybody feared, needed a hat. He entered the shop of Don Antonio Fortuny, and after a quick glance at the premises, he looked at the hatter and his assistant, the young Julian, and said as follows.
I've been told that, despite appearances, the best hats in Barcelona come out of this shop. Autumn is looking decidedly grim, and I'm going to need 6 top hats, 12 bowler hats, hunting caps, and something to wear for the Cortes in Madrid. Are you making a note of this, or do you expect me to repeat it all?
That was the beginning of a laborious and lucrative process, during which father and son combined their efforts to get the order completed for Don Ricardo Aldaya. Julian, who read the papers, was well aware of Aldaya's position, and told himself he could not fail his father now, at the most crucial and decisive moment of his business career. From the moment the magnate had set foot in his shop, the hatter almost levitated with joy. Aldaya had promised him that if he was satisfied, he would recommend his establishment to all his friends. That meant that the Fortuny hat shop, from being a dignified but modest enterprise, would attain the highest spheres, covering the heads both large and small of parliamentary members, mayors, cardinals and ministers. That week seemed to fly by, like an enchanted dream. Julian skipped school and spent up to 18 or 20 hours a day working in the backroom workshop. His father, exhausted by his own enthusiasm, hugged him every now and then and even kissed him without thinking. He even went so far as to give his wife, Sophie, a dress and a pair of new shoes for the first time in 14 years. The hatter was unrecognizable. One Sunday he forgot to go to church, and that same afternoon, brimming with pride, he put his arms around Julian and said with tears in his eyes, "Grandfather would have been proud of us." One of the most complex processes of the now disappeared science of hat-making, both technically and politically, was that of taking measurements. Don Ricardo Aldaya had a cranium that, according to Julian, bordered on the melon-shaped and was quite rugged. The hatter was aware of the difficulties as soon as he saw the great man's head, and that same evening, when Julian said it reminded him of certain peaks in the mountains of Montserrat, Fortuny couldn't help agreeing with him.
"Father, with all due respect, you know that when it comes to taking measurements I'm better at it than you, because you get nervous. Let me do it."
The hatter readily agreed, and the following day, when Aldaya arrived in his Mercedes-Benz, Julian welcomed him and took him to the workshop. When Aldaya realised that he was going to be measured by a boy of 14, he was furious.
"What was this, a child? Are you pulling my leg?"
Julian, who was aware of his client's social position, but who wasn't in the least bit intimidated by him, answered,
"Sir, I don't know about your leg, but there's not much to pull up here. This crown looks like a bullring, and if we don't hurry up and make you a set of hats, your head will be mistaken for a Barcelona street plan."
When he heard those words, Fortuny wanted the ground to swallow him up. Aldaya, undaunted, fixed his gaze on Julian. Then, to everyone's surprise, he burst out laughing, as he hadn't done in years.
"Oh, this child of yours will go far, Fortunato," declared Aldaya,
who had not quite learned the hatter's surname. That is how they discovered that Don Ricardo Aldaya was fed up to his very back teeth with being feared and flattered by everyone, with having people throw themselves on the ground like a doormat as he went by. He despised sycophants, cowards, and anyone who showed any sort of weakness, be it physical, mental, or moral. When he came across a humble boy, barely an apprentice, who had the cheek and the spirit to laugh at him, Aldaya decided he'd hit on the ideal hat shop and immediately doubled his order. That week he gladly turned up every day for his appointment, so that Julian could take measurements and try different models on him. Antoni Fortuny was amazed to see how the champion of Catalan society would fall about laughing at the jokes and stories told by the son who was still a stranger to him. That boy he never spoke to, and who for years had shown no sign of having any sense of humour. At the end of the week, Aldaya took the hatter aside, to a corner of the shop, and spoke to him in confidence.
"Let's see, Fortunato. This son of yours has great talent, and you've got him stuck here, bored out of his mind, dusting the cobwebs in a two-bit shop."
"This is a good business, Don Ricardo, and the boy shows a certain flair, even though he lacks backbone."
"Nonsense! What school does he attend?"
"Well, he goes to the local school."
"Nothing but a production line for workers. One is young. Talent, genius if you like, must be cultivated, or it becomes twisted and consumes the person who possesses it. It needs direction, support. Do you understand me, Fortunato?"
"You're mistaken about my son. He's nowhere near a genius. He can barely pass his geography. His teachers tell me he's a scatterbrain and has a very bad attitude, just like his mother. But at least here he'll always have an honest job and..."
"Fortunato, you bore me. Today, without fail, I'll go to San Gabriel School to see the admissions board, and I'll let them know that they are to accept your son into the same class as my eldest child, Jorge. Anything less would be miserly of me."
The hatter's eyes were as big as saucers. San Gabriel's was the nursery for the cream of high society.
"But, Don Ricardo, I would be unable to finance..." "No one is asking you to pay anything. I'll take charge of the boy's education. You, as his father, only have to agree." "But of course, certainly, but..." "That's decided then, so long as Julian accepts, of course."
"He'll do what he's told, naturally." At this point in the conversation, Julian stuck his head round the door of the back room, with a hat mould in his hands.
"Don Ricardo, whenever you're ready..." "Tell me, Julian, what are you doing this afternoon?" Aldaya asked.
Julian looked alternately at his father and the tycoon.
"Well, helping my father here in the shop." "Apart from that..."
"I was thinking of going to the library."
"You like books, eh?"
"Yes, sir."
"Have you read Conrad, Heart of Darkness?"
3 times. The hatter frowned, utterly lost.
"And who is this Conrad, if you don't mind my asking?"
Aldaya silenced him with a gesture that seemed like something from a shareholders' meeting.
"In my house, I have a library with 14,000 books, Julian. When I was young, I read a lot. But now I no longer have the time. And come to think of it, I have 3 copies signed by Conrad himself. My son, Jorge, can't even be dragged into the library. The only person who thinks and reads in the house is my daughter, Penelope. So all those books are being wasted. Would you like to see them?"
Julian nodded, speechless. The hatter observed the scene with a sense of unease he couldn't quite define. All those names were unknown to him. Novels, as everyone knew, were for women and for people who had nothing better to do. The Heart of Darkness sounded like a mortal sin at the very least.
"Fortunato, your son is coming with me. I want to introduce him to my son, Jorge.
Don't worry, we'll bring him back to you later. Tell me, young man, have you ever been in a Mercedes-Benz?
Julian presumed that that was the name of the cumbersome, imperial-looking machine the industrialist used for getting around. He shook his head.
Well then, it's about time. It's like going to heaven, but without dying.
And Tony Fortuny watched them leave in that exceedingly luxurious carriage. And when he searched his heart, all he found was sadness. That night, while he had dinner with Sophie, who was wearing her new dress and shoes and had almost no bruises or scars, he asked himself where he had gone wrong this time. Just when God was returning a son to him, Aldaya was taking him away.
Take off that dress, woman! You look like a whore! And don't let me see this wine on the table again! The watered-down sort is quite good enough for us. Greed will corrupt us all in the end!
Julian had never crossed over to the other side of Avenida Diagonal. That line of groves, empty plots of land and palaces awaiting the expansion of the city was a forbidden frontier. Hamlets, hills and mysterious places rumoured to contain unimaginable wealth extended beyond it. As they passed through, Aldaya talked to Julian about San Gabriel's, about new friends Julian had never set eyes on, about a future he had not thought possible.
What do you aspire to, Julian? In life, I mean.
I don't know. Sometimes I think I'd like to be a writer, a novelist.
Like Conrad, hey?
Oh, you're very young, of course.
And tell me, doesn't banking tempt you?
I don't know, sir. The truth is that it hadn't ever entered my head. I've never seen more than 3 pesetas together. High finance is a mystery to me.
Aldaya laughed.
There's no mystery, Julian. The trick is not to put pesetos together in threes, but in 3 million. That way there's no enigma, I can assure you. No holy trinity.
That afternoon, as he drove up Avenida del Tibidabo, Julian thought he was entering the doors of paradise. Mansions that seemed like cathedrals flanked the way. Halfway along the avenue, the driver turned and they went through the gates of one of them. Instantly, an army of servants set about receiving the master. All Julian could see was a large, majestic house with 3 floors. It never occurred to him that real people could live in places like this. He let himself be taken through the lobby. Then he crossed a vaulted hall from where a marble staircase rose, framed by velvet curtains, and finally entered a large room whose walls were a tapestry of books from floor to ceiling.
What do you think? Asked Aldaya.
Julian was barely listening.
Damian, tell Jorge to come down to the library immediately.
The faceless and silent servants glided away at the slightest order from the master, with the efficiency and submissiveness of a body of well-trained insects.
You're going to need a new wardrobe, Julian. There are a lot of morons out there who only go by appearances. I'll tell Jacinta to take care of that. You don't have to worry about it. And it's probably best if you don't mention it to your father in case it annoys him. Ah, look! Here comes Jorge. Jorge, I want you to meet a wonderful young man who's going to be your new classmate. Julian for...
Julian Carax, he corrected.
Julian Carax, repeated a satisfied Aldaya. I like the sound of it. This is my son, Jorge.
Julian held out his hand, and Jorge Aldaya shook it. His touch was lukewarm, unenthusiastic, and his face had a pale, chiselled look that came from having grown up in that doll-like world. To Julian, his clothes and shoes seemed like something out of a novel. His eyes gave off an air of bravado and arrogance, of disdain and sugary politeness. Julian smiled at him openly, reading insecurity, fear and emptiness under that shell of vanity. Is it true that you haven't read any of these books?
Books are boring.
Books are mirrors. You only see in them what you already have inside you, answered Julian. Don Ricardo Aldaya laughed again.
Well, I'll leave you two alone so you can get to know each other. Julian, you'll see that although he seems spoiled and conceited, underneath that mask, Jorge isn't as stupid as he looks. He has something of his father in him.
Aldair's words seemed to fall like knives on the boy, although he didn't let his smile fade at all. Julian regretted his answer and felt sorry for him.
You must be the Hatter's son, said Jorge, without malice. My father talks about you a lot these days.
It's the novelty. I hope you don't hold that against me. Under this mask of a know-it-all meddler, I'm not such an idiot as I seem.
Jorge smiled at him. Julian thought he smiled the way people smile who have no friends. With gratitude.
Come, I'll show you the rest of the house.
They left the library behind them and went off towards the main door in the gardens. When they crossed the hall with the staircase, Julian looked up and glimpsed a figure ascending the stairs with one hand on the banister. He felt as if he were caught up in a vision. The girl must have been about 12 or 13 and was escorted by a mature woman, small and rosy-cheeked, who looked like a governess. The girl wore a blue satin dress. Her hair was the colour of almonds, and the skin on her shoulders and slim neck seemed translucent. She stopped at the top of the stairs and turned around briefly. For a second their eyes met, and she offered him the ghost of a smile. Then the governess put her arms round the girl's shoulders and led her to the entrance of a corridor into which they both disappeared. Julian looked down, and he fixed his eyes on Jorge's again.
That's Penelope, my sister. You'll meet her later. She's a bit nutty. She spends all day reading. Come on, I want to show you the chapel in the basement. The cooks say it's haunted.
Julian followed the boy meekly, but he cared little about anything else. Now he understood. He had dreamed about her countless times, on that same staircase, with that same blue dress, and that same movement of her ash-grey eyes, without knowing who she was or why she smiled at him. When he went out into the garden, he let himself be led by Jorge as far as the coach houses and the tennis courts that stretched out beyond. Only then did he turn around to look back and saw her in her window on the second floor. He could barely make out her shape, but he knew she was smiling at him and that somehow she too had recognised him. That fleeting glimpse of Penelope Aldaya at the top of the staircase remained with him during his first weeks at San Gabriel's. His new world was not all to his liking. The pupils at San Gabriel's behaved like haughty, arrogant princes, while their teachers were like docile servants. The first friend Julian made there, apart from Jorge Aldaya, was a boy called Fernando Ramos, the son of one of the cooks at the school, who would never have imagined he would end up wearing a cassock and teaching in the same classrooms in which he himself had grown up. Fernando, whom the rest nicknamed the kitchen sweep, and whom they treated like a servant, was alert and intelligent, but had hardly any friends among the schoolboys. His only companion was an eccentric boy called Miquel Moliner, who in time would become the best friend Julian ever made at the school. Miquel Moliner, who had too much brain and too little patience, enjoyed teasing his teachers by questioning all their statements, using clever arguments in which he displayed both ingenuity and a poisonous sting. The rest feared his sharp tongue and considered him a member of some other species. In a way, this was not entirely mistaken, for despite his bohemian traits and the unaristocratic tone he affected, Miquel was the son of a businessman who had become obscenely rich through the manufacture of arms.
Carax, isn't it? I'm told your father makes hats, he said when Fernando Ramos introduced them.
Julian to my friends. I'm told yours makes cannons.
He just sells them, actually. The only thing he knows how to make is money. My friends, among whom I only count Nietzsche and Fernando here, call me Miquel.
Miquel Moliner was a sad boy. He suffered with an unhealthy obsession with death and all matters funereal, a field to the consideration of which he dedicated much of his time and talent. His mother had died 3 years earlier, as a result of a strange domestic accident, which some foolish doctor had dared describe as suicide. It was Mikael who had discovered the body shining under the waters of the well, in the summer mansion the family owned in Argentona. When they pulled her out with ropes, they found that the pockets of the dead woman's coat were filled with stones. There was also a letter written in German, the mother's native tongue. But Signor Molinaire, who had never bothered to learn the language, burned it that very afternoon, without allowing anyone to read it. Mikael Molinaire saw death everywhere, in fallen leaves, in birds that had dropped out of their nests, in old people, and in the rain, which swept everything away. He was exceptionally talented at drawing, and would often become distracted for hours, creating charcoal sketches in which a lady whom Julian took to be his mother always appeared against a background of mist and deserted beaches.
What do you want to be when you grow up, Mikael?
I'll never grow up, he would answer enigmatically. His main interest, apart from sketching and contradicting every living soul, was the work of a mysterious Austrian doctor who in years to come would be famous, Sigmund Freud. Thanks to his deceased mother, Mikael Molinaire read and wrote perfect German, and he owned a number of books by the Viennese doctor. His favourite field was the interpretation of dreams. He used to ask people what they had dreamed, and would then make a diagnosis. He always said he was going to die young, and that he didn't mind. Julian believed that by thinking so much about death, he had ended up finding more sense in it than in life. The day I die, all that was once mine will be yours, Julian, he would say, except my dreams. Besides Fernando Ramos, Molinaire and Jorge Aldaya, Julian also befriended a shy and rather unsociable boy called Javier, the only son of the caretakers of San Gabriel's, who lived in a modest house stationed at the entrance to the school gardens. Javier, who, like Fernando, was considered by the rest of the boys to be no more than an irritating lackey, prowled about alone in the gardens and courtyards of the compound. From so much wandering around the school, he ended up knowing every nook and cranny of the building, from the tunnels in the basements to the passages up to the towers, and all kinds of hiding places that nobody remembered anymore. They were his secret world and his refuge. He always carried with him a penknife he had removed from one of his father's drawers, and he liked to carve wooden figures with it, keeping them in the school dovecote. His father, Ramon, the caretaker, was a veteran of the Cuban War, where he had lost a hand and, it was maliciously rumoured, his right testicle, as a result of a pellet shot from Theodore Roosevelt himself during the raid of the Bay of Cochinos. Convinced that idleness was the mother of all evil, Ramon One-Ball, as the schoolboys nicknamed him, set his son the task of gathering up all the fallen leaves from the pine grove and the courtyard around the fountains in a sack. Ramon was a good man, rather coarse and fatally given to choosing bad company, most notably his wife. He had married a strapping, dim-witted woman, with delusions of grandeur, and the look of a scullion, who was wont to dress skimpily in front of her son and the other boys, a habit that gave rise to no end of mirth and ridicule. Her Christian name was Maria Craponcia, but she called herself Yvonne because she thought it more elegant. Yvonne used to question her son about the possibilities for social advancement that his friends presented, for she believed that he was making connections with the elite of Barcelona society. She would ask him about the fortune of this or that one, imagining herself dressed in the best silks and being received for tea in the great salons of good society. Javier tried to spend as little time as possible in the house and was grateful for the jobs his father gave him, however hard they might be. Any excuse was good in order to be alone, to escape into his secret world and carve his wooden figures. When the schoolboys saw him from afar, some would laugh or throw stones at him. One day Julian felt so sorry for him when he saw how a stone had gashed the boy's forehead and knocked him onto a pile of rubble, that he decided to go to his aid and offer him his friendship. At first Javier thought that Julian was coming to finish him off while the others fell about laughing.
"My name is Julian," he said, stretching out his hand. "My friends and I were about to go and play chess in the pine grove, and I wondered whether you'd like to join us." "I don't know how to play chess." "Nor did I until 2 weeks ago, but Mikel is a good teacher." The boy looked at him suspiciously, expecting the prank, the hidden attack, at any moment. "I don't know whether your friends will want me there."
"It was their idea. What do you say?"
From that day on, Javier would sometimes join them after finishing the jobs he had been assigned. He didn't usually say anything, but would listen and watch the others. Aldaya was slightly fearful of him. Fernando, who had himself experienced the rejection of others because of his humble origins, would go out of his way to be kind to the strange boy. Mikel Molinaire, who taught him the rudiments of chess and watched him with a careful eye, was the most sceptical of all. "That boy is a nutter. He catches cats and pigeons and tortures them for hours with his knife. Then he buries them in the pine grove. Delightful."
"Who said so?"
"He told me so himself the other day, while I was explaining the knight's moves to him. He also told me that sometimes his mother gets into his bed at night and fondles him."
"He must have been pulling your leg."
"I doubt it. That kid isn't right in the head, Julian, and it's probably not his fault."
Julian struggled to ignore Mikel's warnings and predictions, but the fact was that he was finding it difficult to establish a friendship with the son of the caretaker. Yvonne in particular did not approve of Julian or of Fernando Ramos. Of all the young men, they were the only ones who didn't have a single peseta. Rumour had it that Julian's father was a simple shopkeeper and that his mother had only got as far as being a music teacher.
"Those people have no money, class or elegance, my love," his mother would lecture him. "The one you should befriend is Aldaya. He comes from a very good family."
"Yes, mother," the boy would answer, "whatever you say." As time went by, Javier seemed to start trusting his new friends. Occasionally he said a few words, and he was carving a set of chess pieces for Mikel Molinaire in appreciation for his lessons. One day, when nobody expected it or thought it possible, they discovered that Javier knew how to smile and that he had the innocent laugh of a child.
"You see, he's just a normal boy," Julian argued.
Mikel Molinaire remained unconvinced, and he observed the strange lad with a rigorous scrutiny that was almost scientific. "Javier is obsessed with you, Julian," he told him one day. "Everything he does is only to earn your approval."
"What nonsense! He has a mother and a father for that. I'm only a friend."
"Irresponsible, that's what you are. His father is a poor wretch who has trouble finding his own bum, and Doña Yvonne is a harpy with a brain of a flea who spends her time pretending to meet people by chance in her underwear, convinced that she is Venus incarnate or something far worse I'd rather not mention. The boy, quite naturally, is looking for a substitute, and you, the saviour, fall from heaven and give him your hand. St. Julian of the Fountain, patron saint of the dispossessed."
"This Dr. Freud is rotting your brains, Mikel. We all need friends, even you."
"That kid doesn't have friends and never will. He has the heart of a spider. And if you don't believe me, time will tell. I wonder what he dreams about."
Mikel Molinaire could not know that Francisco Javier's dreams were more like his friend Julian's than he would ever have thought possible. Once, some months before Julian had started at the school, the caretaker's son was gathering dead leaves from the fountain courtyard when Don Ricardo Aldaya's luxurious automobile arrived. That afternoon, the tycoon had company. He was escorted by an apparition, an angel of light dressed in silk, who seemed to hover above the ground. The angel, who was none other than Aldaya's daughter Penelope, stepped out of the Mercedes and walked over to one of the fountains, waving her parasol and stopping to splash the water of the pond with her hands. As usual, her governess, Jacinta, followed her dutifully, observant of the slightest gesture from the girl. It wouldn't have mattered if an army of servants had guarded her. Javier only had eyes for the girl. He was afraid that if he blinked, the vision would vanish. He remained there, paralysed,
breathlessly spying on the mirage. Soon after, as if the girl had sensed his presence and his furtive gaze, Penelope raised her eyes and looked in his direction. The beauty of that face seemed painful, unsustainable. He thought he saw the hint of a smile on her lips. Terrified, Habia ran off to hide at the top of the water tower, next to the dovecot in the attic of the school building, his favourite hiding place. His hands were still shaking when he gathered his carving utensils and began to work on a new piece in the form of the face he had just sighted. When he returned to the caretaker's home that night, hours later than usual, his mother was waiting for him, half naked and furious. The boy looked down, fearing that if his mother read his eyes, she would see in them the girl from the pond and know what he'd been thinking about.
"And where have you been, you little shit?"
"I'm sorry, Mother, I got lost."
"You've been lost since the day you were born!"
Years later, every time he stuck his revolver into the mouth of a prisoner and pulled the trigger, Chief Inspector Francisco Javier Fumero would remember the day he saw his mother's head burst open, like a ripe watermelon, near an outdoor bar in Las Planas, and didn't feel anything. Just the tedium of dead things. The civil guard alerted the manager of the bar, who had heard the shot, found the boy sitting on a rock holding a smoking shotgun on his lap. He was staring impassively at the decapitated body of Maria Craponcia, alias Yvonne, covered in insects. When he saw the guards coming over to him, he just shrugged his shoulders, his face splattered with blood, as if he were being ravaged by smallpox. Following the sobs, the civil guards found Ramon Oneball squatting by a tree some 30 yards away in the undergrowth. He was shaking like a child and was unable to make himself understood. The lieutenant of the civil guard, after much deliberation, reported that the event had been a tragic accident, and so he recorded it in his statement, though not on his conscience. When they asked the boy if there was anything they could do for him, Francisco Javier asked whether he could keep that old gun because, when he grew up, he wanted to be a soldier.
"Are you feeling all right, Señor Romero de Torres?"
The sudden appearance of Fumero in Father Fernando Ramos's narrative had stunned me, but the effect on Fermín was devastating. He looked white as a sheet, and his hands shook.
"A sudden drop in my blood pressure," Fermín improvised in a tiny voice.
"This Catalan climate can be hell for us southerners."
"May I offer you a glass of water?" asked the priest in a worried tone.
"If your grace wouldn't mind, and perhaps a chocolate for the glucose, you know."
The priest poured him a glass of water, which Fermín drank greedily.
"All I have are some eucalyptus sweets. Would they be of any help?"
"God bless you."
Fermín swallowed a fistful of sweets, and after a while seemed to recover his natural pallor.
"This boy, the son of the caretaker who heroically lost his scrotum defending the colonies, are you sure his name was Fumero? Francisco Javier Fumero?"
"Yes, quite sure."
"Do you know him?"
"No,"
we intoned in unison. Father Fernando frowned.
"It wouldn't have surprised me. Regrettably, Francisco Javier has ended up being a notorious character."
"We're not sure we understand you."
"You understand me perfectly. Francisco Javier Fumero is chief inspector of the Barcelona crime squad and is widely known. His reputation's even reached those of us who never leave this establishment. And I'd say that when you heard his name, you shrank a couple of inches."
"Now that you mention it, Your Excellency, the name does ring a bell."
Father Fernando looked sidelong at us.
"This young man isn't the son of Julian Carax, am I right?"
"Spiritual son, Your Eminency. Morally, that has more weight."
"What kind of mess are you two in? Who has sent you?"
At that point, I was certain we were about to be kicked out of the priest's office, and I decided to silence Fermín and, for once, play the honesty card.
"You're right, Father. Julian Carax isn't my father.
but nobody has sent us. Years ago, I happened to come across a book by Carax, a book that was thought to have disappeared. And from that time on, I have tried to discover more about him and clarify the circumstances of his death. Señor Romero de Torres has helped me.
What book?
The Shadow of the Wind. Have you read it?
I've read all of Julián's novels.
Have you kept them?
The priest shook his head.
May I ask what you did with them?
Years ago, someone came into my room and set fire to them.
Do you suspect anyone?
Of course. I suspect Fumero. Isn't that why you're here?
Fermín and I exchanged puzzled looks.
Inspector Fumero? Why would he want to burn the books?
Who else would? During the last year we spent together at school, Francisco Javier tried to kill Julián with his father's shotgun. If Miquel hadn't stopped him.
Why did he try to kill him? Julián had been his only friend.
Francisco Javier was obsessed with Penelope Aldaya. Nobody knew this. I don't think Penelope had even noticed the boy's existence. He kept the secret for years. Apparently he used to follow Julián. I think one day he saw him kiss her. I don't know. What I do know is that he tried to kill him in broad daylight. Miquel Moliner, who had never trusted Fumero, threw himself on him and stopped him at the last moment. The hole made by the bullet is still visible by the entrance. Every time I go past it, I remember that day.
What happened to Fumero?
He and his family were thrown out of the place. I think Francisco Javier was sent to a boarding school for a while. We heard no more about him until a couple of years later when his mother died in a hunting accident. There was no such accident. Francisco Javier Fumero is a murderer.
If I were to tell you, mumbled Fermín,
it wouldn't be a bad thing if one of you did tell me something, but something true, for a change.
We can tell you that Fumero was not the person who burned your books.
Who was it then?
In all likelihood, it was a man whose face is disfigured by burns. A man who calls himself Laín Cubert.
Isn't that the one?
I nodded. The name of one of Carax's characters.
The devil.
Father Fernando leaned back in his armchair, almost as confused as we were.
What does seem increasingly clear is that Penelope Aldaya is at the centre of all this business, and she's the person we know least about, Fermín remarked.
I don't think I can help you there. I hardly ever saw her, and then only from a distance, two or three times. What I know about her is what Julián told me, which wasn't much. The only other person who I heard mention Penelope's name a few times was Jacinta Coronado.
Jacinta Coronado?
Penelope's governess. She raised Jorge and Penelope. She loved them madly, especially Penelope. Sometimes she would come to the school to collect Jorge, because Don Ricardo Aldaya wanted his children to be watched over at all times by some member of his household. Jacinta was an angel. She had heard that both Julián and I came from modest families, so she would always bring us afternoon snacks, because she thought we went hungry. I would tell her that my father was the cook and not to worry, for I was never without something to eat, but she insisted. Sometimes I'd wait and talk to her. She was the kindest person I've ever met. She had no children or any boyfriend that I knew of. She was alone in the world and had devoted her life to the Aldaya children. She simply adored Penelope. She still talks about her.
Are you still in touch with Jacinta?
I sometimes visit her in the Santa Lucia hospice. She doesn't have anyone. For reasons we cannot comprehend, the good Lord doesn't always reward us during our lifetime. Jacinta is now a very old woman, and is as alone as she has always been.
Fermín and I exchanged looks.
What about Penelope? Hasn't she ever visited her?
Father Fernando's eyes grew dark and impenetrable.
Nobody knows what happened to Penelope. That girl was Jacinta's life,
When the Aldaeas left for America and she lost her, she lost everything.
Why didn't they take her with them? Did Penelope go to Argentina with the rest of the Aldaeas? I asked.
The priest shrugged his shoulders. I don't know. Nobody ever saw Penelope again or heard anything about her after 1919.
The year Carax left for Paris, Fermin observed.
You must promise me that you're not going to bother this poor old lady and stir up painful memories for her.
Who do you take us for, Father?
Asked Fermin, annoyed.
Suspecting that he would get no more from us, Father Fernando made us swear to him that he would keep him informed about any new discoveries we made.
To reassure him, Fermin insisted on swearing on a new testament that lay on the priest's desk.
Leave the Gospels alone. Your word is enough for me.
You don't let anything pass you, do you, Father? You're sharp as a nail.
Come, let me accompany you to the door.
He led us through the garden until we reached the spiked gate and then stopped at a reasonable distance from the exit, gazing at the street that wound its way down towards the real world, as if he were afraid he might evaporate if he ventured out a few steps further. I wondered when Father Fernando had last left the school grounds.
I was very sad when I heard that Julian had died, he said softly. Despite everything that happened afterwards, and the fact that we grew apart as time went by, we were good friends. Mikel, Aldaya, Julian, and myself. Even Fumero. I always thought we were going to be inseparable. But life must know things that we don't know. I've never had friends like those again, and I don't imagine I ever will. I hope you find what you're looking for, Daniel.
Chapter 26. It was almost mid-morning when we reached Paseo de la Bonanova, wrapped in our own thoughts. I had little doubt that Fermin's were largely devoted to the sinister appearance of Inspector Fumero in the story. I glanced over at him and noticed that he seemed consumed by anxiety. A veil of dark red clouds bled across the sky, punctured by splinters of light the colour of fallen leaves.
If we don't hurry, we're going to get caught in a downpour, I said.
Not yet. Those clouds look like nighttime, like a bruise. They're the sort that wait.
Don't tell me you're also an expert on clouds, Fermin.
Living on the streets has unexpected educational side effects. Listen, just thinking about this Fumero business has stirred my juices. Would you object to a stop at the bar in the Plaza de Sarriá to polish off two well-endowed omelette sandwiches plus trimmings?
We set off towards the square, where a knot of old folks hovered around the local pigeon community, their lives reduced to a ritual of spreading crumbs and waiting. We found ourselves a table near the entrance, and Fermin proceeded to wolf down the two sandwiches, his and mine, a pint of beer, two chocolate bars, and a triple coffee heavily laced with rum and sugar. For dessert, he had a suga sweet. A man sitting at the next table glanced at Fermin over his newspaper, probably thinking the same thing I was.
I don't see how you fit it all in, Fermin.
In my family, we've always had a speedy metabolism. My sister, Jesusa, God rest her soul, was capable of eating a six-egg omelette with blood sausage in the middle of the afternoon and then tucking in like a Cossack at night. Poor thing. She was just like me, you know. Same face and same classic figure, rather on the lean side. A doctor from Cáceres once told my mother that the Romero de Torres family was the missing link between man and the hammerhead, for 90% of our organism is cartilage, mainly concentrated in the nose and the outer ear. Jesusa was often mistaken for me in the village because she never grew breasts and began to shave before I did. She died of consumption when she was 22. A virgin to the end, and secretly in love with a sanctimonious priest who, when he met her in the street, always said, "Hello, Fermin, you're becoming quite a dashing young man."
Life's ironies.
Do you miss them? The family?
Fermin shrugged his shoulders, caught in a nostalgic smile. What do I know? Few things are more deceptive than memories. Look at the priest. And you. Do you miss your mother?
I looked down. A lot.
Do you know what I remember most about mine? Fermin asked. Her smell. She always smelled clean, like a loaf of sweet bread. It didn't matter if she'd spent the day working in the fields or was wearing the same odd rag she'd worn all week. She always smelled of the best things in this world. And mind you, she was pretty uncouth. She could swear like a trooper, but she smelled like a fairy tale princess. Or at least, that's what I thought. What about you? What is it you remember most about your mother, Daniel? I hesitated for a moment, clawing at the words my lips couldn't shape. Nothing. For years now, I haven't been able to remember my mother. I can't remember what her face was like, or her voice, or her smell. I lost them all the day I discovered Julian Carax, and they haven't come back. Fermin watched me cautiously, considering his reply.
Don't you have a photograph of her?
I've never wanted to look for them, I said.
Why not?
I'd never told anyone this, not even my father or Tomas. Because I'm afraid. I'm afraid of looking at a photograph of my mother and discovering that she's a stranger. You probably think that's nonsense. Fermin shook his head.
And is that why you believe that if you manage to unravel the mystery of Julian Carax and rescue him from oblivion, the face of your mother will come back to you?
I looked at him. There was no irony or judgment in his expression. For a moment, Fermin Romero de Torres seemed to me the wisest and most lucid man in the universe.
Perhaps,
I said without thinking. At noon on the dot, we got on a bus that would take us back downtown. We sat at the front, just behind the driver, a circumstance Fermin used as an excuse to hold a discussion with the man about the many advances, both technical and cosmetic, that he had noticed in public transportation since the last time he'd used it, circa 1940, especially with regard to signs, as was borne out by the notice that read, "Spitting and foul language are strictly forbidden." Fermin looked briefly at the sign and decided to acknowledge it by energetically clearing his throat of phlegm. This granted us a sharp look of disapproval from a trio of saintly ladies who travelled like a commando unit at the back of the bus, each one armed with a missile.
"You savage," murmured the bigot on the eastern flank, who bore a remarkable likeness to the official portrait of Il Duce, but with curls.
"There they go," said Fermin. "Three saints has my Spain, St. Holier Than Thou, St. Holy Shit, and St. Holy Cow. Between us all, we've turned this country into a joke."
"You can say that again," agreed the driver. "We were better off with a republic. To say nothing of the traffic, it stinks."
The man sitting at the back of the bus laughed, enjoying the exchange of views. I recognised him as the same fellow who had sat next to us in the bar. His expression seemed to suggest that he was on Fermin's side, and that he wanted to see him get merciless with the diehards. We exchanged a quick glance. He gave me a friendly smile and returned to his newspaper. When we got to Calle Grand Auxerre, I noticed that Fermin had curled up in a ball under his raincoat and was having a nap with his mouth wide open, an expression of bliss and innocence on his face. The bus was gliding through the wealthy domains of Paseo de San Gervasio when Fermin suddenly woke up.
"I've been dreaming about Father Fernando," he told me, "except that in my dream he was dressed as the centre-forward for Real Madrid. And he had the League Cup next to him, shining like the Holy Grail."
"I wonder why," I asked.
"If Freud is right, this probably means that the priest has sneaked in a goal for us."
He struck me as an honest man. Fair enough, perhaps too honest for his own good. All priests with the makings of a saint end up being sent off to the missions to see whether the mosquitoes or the piranhas will finish them off.
Don't exaggerate. What blessed innocence, Daniel. You'd even believe in the tooth fairy. All right, just to give you an example,
The tall tale about Michael Molinaire that Nuria Montfort landed on you. I think the wench told you more whoppers than the editorial page of La Salvatore Romano. Now, it turns out that she's married to a childhood friend of Aldaya and Carax. Isn't that a coincidence? And on top of that, we have the story of Jacinta, the good nurse, which might be true but sounds too much like the last act in a play by Alexandre Dumas the Younger, not to mention the star appearance of Fumero. Then do you think Father Fernando lied to us? No. I agree with you that he seems honest, but the uniform carries a lot of weight, and he may well have kept an ora pro nobis or two up his sleeve, if you get my drift. I think that if he lied, it was by way of holding back or decorum, not out of spite or malice. Besides, I don't imagine him capable of inventing such a story. If he could lie better, he wouldn't be teaching algebra and Latin. He'd be in the bishopric by now, growing fat in an office like a cardinal's and plunging soft sponge cakes in his coffee. What do you suggest we do then? Sooner or later, we're going to have to dig up the mummified corpse of the angelic granny and shake it from the ankles to see what falls out. For the time being, I'm going to pull a few strings and see what I can find out about this Michael Molinaire. And it wouldn't be a bad idea to keep an eye on that Nuria Montfort. I think she's turning out to be what my deceased mother would have called a sly old fox. You're mistaken about her, I claimed. You're shown a pair of nice breasts, and you think you've seen St. Teresa, which at your age can be excused, but not cured. Just leave it to me, Daniel. The fragrance of the eternal female no longer overpowers me the way it mesmerizes you. At my age, the flow of blood to the brain takes precedence over that which flows to the loins. Look who's talking. Fermin pulled out his wallet and started to count his money. You have a fortune there, I said. Is it all changed from this morning? Partly. The rest is legitimate. I'm taking my Bernarda out today, and I can't refuse that woman anything. If necessary, I would rob the Central Bank of Spain to indulge her every whim. Oh, what about you? What are your plans for the rest of the day? Nothing special. And what about the girl? What girl? Little Bo Peep. Who do you think? Aguilar's sister. I don't know. I don't have any plans. What you don't have, to put it bluntly, is enough balls to take the bull by the horns. At that, the conductor made his way up to us with a tired expression, his mouth juggling a toothpick, which he twisted and turned through his teeth with circus-like dexterity. Excuse me, but the ladies over there want to know if you could use more respectable language. They can mind their own bloody businesses, answered Fermin in a loud voice. The conductor turned towards the three ladies and shrugged, indicating that he had done what he could and was not inclined to get involved in a scuffle over a matter of semantic modesty. People who have no life always have to stick their nose into the life of others, said Fermin. What were we talking about? About my lack of guts. Right, a textbook case. Trust you me, young man. Go after your girl. Life flies by, especially the bit that's worth living. You heard what the priest said, like a flash. She's not my girl. Well then, make her yours before someone else takes her, especially the little tin soldier. You talk as if Bea were a trophy. No, as if she were a blessing, Fermin corrected. Look, Daniel, destiny is usually just around the corner, like a thief, a hooker, or a lottery vendor. It's three most common personifications, but what destiny does not do is home visits. You have to go for it yourself. I spent the rest of the journey considering this pearl of wisdom, while Fermin had another snooze, an occupation for which he had a Napoleonic talent. We got off the bus on the corner of Gran Vía and Paseo de Gracia, under a leaden sky that stole the light of day. Buttoning his raincoat up to his neck, Fermin announced that he was departing in a hurry towards his pension to smarten up for his meeting with Bernarda. You must understand that with rather modest looks, such as mine, basic beautification requires at least 90 minutes. You don't get far without some looks. That's the sad truth about these dishonest times. Vanitas peccata mundi. I saw him walk away down Gran Vía, barely a sketch of a little man, sheltering himself in a drab raincoat that flapped in the wind like a ragged flag. I started off for home, where I planned to recruit a good book and hide away from the world. When I turned the corner of Puerta del Ángel and Calle Santana, my heart missed a beat. As usual, Fermín had been right. Destiny was waiting for me in front of the bookshop, clad in a tight grey wool suit, new shoes and silk stockings, studying her reflection in the shop window. "My father thinks I've gone to 12 o'clock mass," said Bea, without looking up from her own image.
"You could easily be there. There's been a continuous performance since 9 o'clock this morning, less than 20 yards from here, in the Church of Santa Anna."
We spoke like two strangers who have casually stopped by a shop window, looking for each other's eyes in the pane.
"Let's not make a joke of it. I've had to pick up a church leaflet to see what the sermon was about. He's going to ask me for a detailed synopsis."
"Your father thinks of everything.
He's sworn he'll break your legs. Before that, you'll have to find out who I am, and while my legs are still in one piece, I can run faster than him."
Bea was looking at me tensely, glancing over her shoulder at the people who drifted by behind us in puffs of grey and wind.
"I don't know what you're laughing about," she said. "He means it."
"I'm not laughing. I'm scared shitless. It's just that I'm so happy to see you."
A suggestion of a smile, nervous, fleeting.
"Me too," Bea admitted. "You say it as if it were an illness."
"It's worse than that.
I thought that if I saw you again in daylight, I might come to my senses." I wondered whether that was a compliment or a condemnation. "We can't be seen together, Daniel. Not like this, in full view of everyone. If you like, we can go into the bookshop. There's a coffee pot in the back room and..." "No, I don't want anyone to see me go into or come out of this place. If anyone sees me talking to you now, I can always say I happen to bump into my brother's best friend. If we were seen together more than once, we'll arouse suspicion."
I sighed.
"And who's going to see us? Who cares what we do?
People always have eyes for what is none of their business, and my father knows half of Barcelona."
"So why have you come here to wait for me?"
"I haven't come to wait for you. I've come to church, remember? You said so yourself, 20 yards from here."
"You scare me, Bea. You lie even better than I do."
"You don't know me, Daniel."
"So your brother tells me."
Our eyes met in the reflection.
"The other night, you showed me something I'd never seen before," murmured Bea. "Now it's my turn."
I frowned, intrigued. Bea opened her bag, pulled out a folded card and handed it to me.
"You're not the only person in Barcelona who knows secrets, Daniel. I have a surprise for you. I'll wait for you at this address today, at 4. Nobody must know that we have arranged to meet there."
"How will I know that I've found the right place?"
"You'll know."
I looked at her briefly, praying that she wasn't just making fun of me.
"If you don't come, I'll understand," Bea said. "I'll understand that you don't want to see me anymore."
Without giving me a second to answer, she turned around and walked hurriedly off towards the Ramblas. I was left alone, holding the card, my words still hanging on my lips, my eyes following her until her silhouette melted into the shadows that preceded the storm. I opened the card. Inside, in blue handwriting, was an address I knew. Avenida del Tibidabo, 32.
Chapter 27.
The storm didn't wait until nightfall to show its teeth. The first flashes of lightning caught me by surprise, shortly after taking a bus on line 22. As we went round Plaza Molina and started up Calle Balmes, the city was already beginning to fade behind a curtain of liquid velvet, reminding me that I hadn't even thought of taking an umbrella with me.
"Now that's what I call courage,"
said the conductor when I asked for the stop. It was already 4:10 when the bus left me in the middle of nowhere. Somewhere at the end of Calle Balmes, at the mercy of the storm. Opposite, Avenida del Tibidabo disappeared in a watery mirage. I counted up to three and started to run. Minutes later, soaked to the bone and shivering, I stopped under a doorway to get my breath back. I scrutinised the rest of the route. The storm's icy blast blurred the ghostly outline of mansions and large rambling houses veiled in the mist. Among them rose the dark and solitary tower of the Aldaya mansion, anchored among the swaying trees. I pushed my soaking hair away from my eyes and began to run toward it, crossing the deserted avenue. The small door encased within the gates swung in the wind. Beyond it, a path wound its way up to the house. I slipped in through the door and made my way across the property. Through the undergrowth, I could make out the pedestals of statues that had been knocked down. As I neared the mansion, I noticed that one of the statues, the figure of an avenging angel, had been dumped into the fountain that was the centrepiece of the garden. Its blackened marble shone, ghost-like, beneath the sheet of water that flowed over the edge of the bowl. The hand of the fiery angel emerged from the water, an accusing finger, as sharp as a bayonet, pointing towards the front door of the house. The carved oak door seemed to be ajar. I pushed it and ventured a few steps into a cavernous entrance hall, its walls flickering with the gentle light of a candle.
"I thought you weren't coming," said Bea.
The corridor was entombed in shadows, and Bea's silhouette stood out against the pallid light of a gallery that opened up beyond. She was sitting on a chair against the wall, a candle at her feet.
"Close the door," she told me without getting up. "The key is in the lock."
I obeyed. The lock creaked with a deathly echo. I heard Bea's footsteps approaching me from behind and felt her touch on my soaking clothes.
"You're trembling. Is it fear or cold?"
"I haven't decided yet. Why are we here?" She smiled in the dark and took my hand.
"Don't you know? I thought you would have guessed."
"This was the Aldaya's house, that's all I know.
How did you manage to get in? And how did you know—"
"Come on, we'll light a fire to warm you up." She led me through the corridor to the gallery, which presided over the inner courtyard of the house. The marble columns and naked walls of the sitting room crept up to the coffered ceiling, which was falling to pieces. You could make out the spaces where paintings and mirrors had once covered the walls, and there were marks on the marble floor where furniture had stood. At one end of the room was a fireplace, laid with a few logs. A pile of old newspapers stood by the poker. The air from the fireplace smelled of recent flames and charcoal. Bea knelt down by the hearth and started to place a few sheets of newspaper among the logs. She pulled out a match and lit them, quickly conjuring up a crown of flames. I imagined she was thinking that I must be dying of curiosity and impatience, so I decided to adopt a nonchalant air, making it very clear that if she wanted to play games with me, she had every chance of losing. But she wore a triumphant smile. Perhaps my trembling hands did not help my acting.
"Do you often come here?" I asked. "This is the first time. Intrigued?"
"Vaguely." She spread out a clean blanket that she took out of a canvas bag. It smelled of lavender.
"Come on, sit here by the fire. You might catch pneumonia, and it would be my fault."
The heat from the blaze revived me. Bea gazed silently at the flames, bewitched.
"Are you going to tell me the secret?" I finally asked.
Bea sighed and moved to one of the chairs. I remained glued to the fire, watching the steam rise from my clothes like a fleeing soul.
"What you call the Aldaya Mansion has, in fact, got its own name. The house is called the Angel of Mist, but hardly anyone knows this. My father's firm has been trying to sell the property for 15 years, but without any luck. The other day, while you were telling me the story of Julian Carax and Penelope Aldaya, I didn't think of it. Later that night at home, I put two and two together and remembered I'd occasionally heard my father talk about the Aldaya family, and about this house in particular.
Yesterday, I went over to my father's office and his secretary, Kasasos, told me the story of the house. Did you know that this wasn't their official residence, but one of their summer houses? I shook my head. The Aldaya's main house was a mansion that was knocked down in 1925 to erect a block of apartments, on the site where Calle Bruch and Calle Mallorca cross today. The building had been designed by Puig y Cadafalch and commissioned by Penelope and Jorge's grandfather, Simón Aldaya, in 1896, when that area was nothing more than fields and irrigation channels. The eldest son of the patriarch Simón, Don Ricardo Aldaya, bought this summer residence at the turn of the century from a rather bizarre character, at a ridiculous price, because the house had a bad reputation. Casasus told me it was cursed, and that even the vendors didn't dare show people around and would dodge the issue with any old pretext.